Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Dev 215. My name is William Tulloch. I'm a senior consultant with Redify.
And I'm Mahesh Krishnan. I work as a principal consultant at Redify. And today we're going to be talking about .NET 4.5. Just, we're going to be talking about just the good stuff. There's a lot of stuff in .NET 4.5. So here's a, kind of like a list of things that we think you'll really like, of this thing that we actually really like and think you'll enjoy it as well.
Yeah. So besides working for Redify, Mahesh and myself have also been co-authors on a book called .NET 4.5 with a fellow, an ex-colleague of ours now, Alex Mackey. 9 months ago, Alex emailed me and in one sentence said, "Do you like to write?" And I foolishly replied, and turned out I'm writing a book. But we thought, hey, it's a 4.5 release, you know, it's a 0.5, you know, 3 months, easy. We'll be done by April and, you know, we can go back to what we like doing. We are only now just finishing the book. And I think this is a very interesting indicator that this, even though it's a 0.5 release, it's a very big release. I mean, it is very significant, the changes that are in this. And it has affected the time and the energy we had to put into writing this book.
Yeah, I'll actually probably add that, you know, when we actually started writing this book, it was in beta at the time, and then it moved on to RC, and then finally to RTM. And the number of times we had to go back and fix things that we actually thought was done, we seemed to just like lots and lots of stuff. So, you know, things actually changed, and, you know, but in the end, you know, we still found it interesting, and the changes were always for the better. So it's all good in the end, I guess.
Yeah, so in this talk, we're going to try and take you through some of the key elements in .NET 4.5. It's not a deep dive. There are some demos, but there's no code being written, which is probably beneficial for everybody. The key things we're going to try and cover are the big picture, what has been the things that have influenced this release, and then we're going to go into some of the areas like core framework, all the web stuff, or as much as we can cover. We're going to go back and look at the three pillars of .NET 3.0. They're still there, and the changes are being made to that. And then other cool stuff, which is really things we couldn't work out how to categorize at the time. So, .NET is 10 years old. And this indicates its level of maturity. And I don't think we remember that, because we kind of just keep rolling along via release. But we're now working with a 10-year-old framework. So there's a little bit of history with that. February 2002, .NET 1.0 was released. I remember when it was released, and it was exciting. I mean, I came from classic ASP background, worked with DAO and ADOs and God knows what else. And so the ideas of ASP web forms, data sets were cool, believe it or not, once somewhere. Garbage collection, these were exciting times. We had a 1.1 release in 2003, which was the, oh, we forgot something release. But then we got to release 2, and these are where we start seeing you get key elements coming out. In the 2.0, we got generics. So no longer were you having to write custom lists anymore. Very good. In 3.0, WPF, WCF, Workflow Foundation, that was WWF until the Wrestling Federation decided they didn't like that. And unfortunately, the lamented card space came out in that release. With 3.5 in 2007, my brain just stops working. We got...
You got Link.
We got Link. I knew there was something. I'm getting all my releases mixed up. And then with 4.0, we got the Taos Parallel Library and a number of other features.
And Dynamic, I would add. That's probably one of the nice things that I liked about .NET 4.
So in August 2012, the RTM came out of .NET 4.5. So what were the key drivers behind this release? First one was improving asynchronous operations. We're now in a place where the computer and the phone is more powerful than the computer I had 5 years ago. You know, people's expectations of how their UI should work have changed. We're also now highly dependent on services that move across security and network boundaries. And with all of these, we need to actually improve how the operation runs. And so improving asynchronous operations is a key part of that. Windows 8 and Windows RT, of course, had an influence on this. Small and large, we won't go into it, but you'll get little things like read-only collections being implemented in the base class library to align with WinRT. One of the more interesting aspects that have affected it is NuGet. Who uses NuGet? Okay, some of you. The interesting thing with this is that a lot of the teams are now pulling parts of their product, if you want to think of it that way, out of the main framework and then releasing them as NuGet packages so that they can actually implement faster release times and be more responsive to customers' requests, to bug fixes and stuff. This changes the nature of the framework. We're finding that the framework's actually getting slimmed down a little bit so that only the core elements exist in the framework and then everything else is added on as a NuGet package. Interestingly enough, stuff that lived outside of the framework has also been moved in with this release. And finally, performance. One of the key claims you'll find across many aspects in this framework is that if you just upgrade your application to .NET 4.5, you will actually see a performance increase. They reduce the footprint of the actual classes, and there's a general performance improvement. And the final thing that's affected it is user's voice. If you've been working this for a while, you know that back in the dim dark days, it was opaque at Microsoft. They weren't really listening to what users wanted. We didn't know what was going on inside there. They are now clearly a lot more responsive to what users want and listening to the features they want to be added in. So let's go into the core framework. The core framework is BCL, Base Class Library, and the CLR. This is the bedrock of everything else that sits in this framework. So anything that changes here is going to ripple through all the other components in the framework. In this talk, we're going to jump slides rather rapidly, so I couldn't tell you my next part. Okay, in this part, we're going to look at three features within the core framework. One of them is well known, and you just got a glimpse of it. And two others you may not be so familiar with. Okay, so the first one, async await, two magic keywords. You have always been able to do asynchronous functions within .NET, but it was like jumping through a lot of hoops to achieve it. Fundamentally, it was a pain in the ass. You had to do callbacks, you had to cast objects, it felt fragile, there's code all over the place. And so a common solution to dealing with asynchronous was to stick up a dialog box, tell the user to wait, and set the cursor to an hourglass. And if you were really, really nice to them, you'd have a progress bar as well. But users aren't happy with that anymore, and we are now in a position where we can make better use of it. So to give you an idea of async, I've got a very quick demo. He's going to get the right button. Okay, so this is a really stupid example. I've got a class here that generates the Fibonacci sequence. I've used the infamous demo thread.sleep so it runs a bit slower. So I'm trying to get it to run like a 386 rather than the machine I am actually running it on. ThreadSleep was written for demos, and that was it. There's no other purpose for it. And I've got two buttons. One will call the method, I've got a synchronous method on it, calculate, and we've got a new async method on it where we've specified async on the control and we've got the await. So why do we want to implement async await? Oh, well, let's find out. It's a WPF app because Windows 8 doesn't let you do thread sleep because it's a demo thing. Okay, if I run get numbers synchronously, I suddenly have an amazingly unresponsive UI. And we actually did this a lot. You know, I wanted to pull some data down from a database. We'd kick it off and I'd just say, ah, there's your data. Implement get numbers asynchronously, we are now getting that data as it's being processed, and amazingly enough, I actually have a responsive application. It really kind of gets that, it's really that simple. Well, sort of. And I still use a dialog box. That's it, that's what async await is, that's two keywords. What, number one? Ah, I had a slide for that too. Okay, so that was really easy. So simple. We could all do this. It's brilliant. But you probably want to know what's going on under the hood. It worries me a little bit that this is so simple. I mean, this to me is a Comic Sans situation because it's like when you give people a lot of fonts and they give them into a Word document, they'll use every font they possibly can. Async await's like that. It is so easy to use that you may be tending to use it everywhere. And I think it's important to have an understanding of what actually goes on under the hood.
So it's kind of a difference between abuse and use, I guess.
So just bear with me. Something's just disappeared. There we go. So what I've done is I'm going to open up that class I used for the Fibonacci sequence and show you the methods that were generated for that. Okay, so this is our synchronous method. It looks basically the same as the one I wrote. And there's nothing different about this. It's nice, it runs, we're all really happy. But let's have a look at what happens when we went to the async version. There's a lot more code sitting there. And actually, it's purely boilerplate code, and it's ripping all our method out of here. And what it's actually doing is here, well, press expand methods, it's created a state machine. So what the compiler does when you mark a method with async is that it goes off and spins up a lot of code. It spins up basically a state machine to handle the asynchronous thing, to know when to call back, to know what it's going to call back to. It will pull all your variables and parameters out and hold it in there. So there's a lot going on. Now, Stephen Tope, who's one of the key drivers behind the TPL, suggests that this can be a problem. If you do a lot of chatty little methods and you make them all away to sync, you're actually adding a lot to your to the underlying classes. The recommendation is to start thinking chunky. Okay? So I just thought I'd show you that. And I got the slides back. So, all things asynchronous. What's happened is that it's not just giving us two keywords as developers, is that they have now all the way through the framework, creating asynchronous methods to facilitate and improve performance. So all the stream, text writer, and text reader classes have new async methods for expensive operations. You'll even find in system.data, and especially around the SQL client, asynchronous methods for open connection and making queries. And this makes sense when you start thinking about using Azure for SQL, SQL for Azure, and you're going to start calling across the wire. You don't want to be holding up your system. And even in WCF, generating a proxy will actually now create both synchronous and asynchronous methods. Okay. Something clicked. Identity. Identity is what we know about a user. It determines whether we trust that person. We determine what they're allowed to or not allowed to do in a system. And within the Microsoft and within the .NET framework, the primary model we have used is a role-based identity. To do this, we've had an interface since .NET 1.0, and our Windows identity, generic identities, etc., inherited from that, implemented that interface. The interface itself was reasonably simple. It had an authentication type. It would tell you whether that user is authenticated or not, and it gave you a username. That's all we know about that person. We managed authorization through the iPrinciple. And again, it's just an interface, and our Windows, our concrete implementations such as Windows Principle and Generic Principle inherited from that. And it was even simpler. It has an instance of an identity, and it has isInRole. Now, the problem with this and using isInRole is that we only can determine people by the roles they're in, which is a fairly limiting thing. It doesn't tell me your email address. It doesn't tell me your name, your real name as opposed to your username. I have no real information about you, so I'm really hamstrung. If you're using roles to manage authorization, you usually end up writing rather complicated kind of exception or if statements or switch statements based on roles. And I've even worked in a company that set up a role for one person because they had some unique parameter. This is very clumsy. As we move into working across systems and interacting with third-party systems, this is even less efficient. So the big thing that's come about is the concept of claims-based identity, which Microsoft has embraced violently, sort of. And so now in .NET 4.5, we now have a new class called the claims identity. It still implements iIdentity, but our concrete classes, Windows Identity, etc., they inherit from that. And the key thing to this is that it has claims. And a claim, just for those that don't know, is really an atomic piece of information about someone. So if we now look at the claims identity class, You can see at the top there, we've still got our I principal, I claim properties, but below that, we've got a collection of claims. And this class also implements a number of helper methods to actually query claims. The same thing is with the principal. We now have a claims principal, and again, it implements the I principal, but it is the thing that all the other principal classes inherit from. And it too has claims. And as you can see here, we still have an identity, we have a set of claims, and you have a collection of identities. So we're introducing a new concept here. A person or system can have multiple identities, which is kind of scary and slightly schizophrenic in my opinion, but you know, whatever works for them. The other thing that's different with this is that the claims there is actually the entire set of claims from all the identities. So the key thing is here is that Microsoft has embraced the concept of claims-based identity, and this has actually been pulled into the framework. It's built in. There is no getting around it. You upgrade to .NET 4.5, you can work with claims. This gets really interesting when we start looking at things like Windows Server 2012, where Active Directory can now export claims. The thing with claims is that it was usually tied to server-side. We first encountered them in WCF 3.0, but it was kind of deep and mysterious and no one wrote about it. And then when Windows Identity Foundation was released in 2009, that's when it started coming to prominence. But we were tending to use it to manage authorization, authentication on websites, on web services. But with AD now exporting claims, you can actually start thinking about it as writing it into your desktop applications. And it gets interesting because the identity and the principal are hooked to the thread. So in your app, you can start dragging around a lot more information about people. Existing identity management doesn't have to change for existing apps when you upgrade. If you're still using isEnroll and you're still using it, nothing breaks. Upgrade, it's still there, but then you can start utilizing it later on. And the part I like, and I'm a big fan of it, Windows Identity Foundation is now built into .NET 4.5, which is kind of, the two have a symbiotic relationship. So they've actually had to pull them, they've actually pulled it in together. And that indicates to me the confidence that the framework team have in the concept of claims identity. I won't be demoing it, but if you're interested in it, I'm always more than happy to talk about it later. Okay, finally, portable class libraries. You used to be able to write classes and you could use it in a service, or I could drop it into an application, and it, you know, it all works. Fortunately, when Silverlight came along, the rot set in. It kind of was close to what we were writing, but not quite what we wanted. So inevitably we ended up having to do conditional compiles to manage Silverlight and say WPF, or my personal favorite, cut and paste coding, because it's robust and it's not open to failure. And it even gets worse when we brought in Windows Phone 7, because that had a third limitation in what we could use. And now with Windows 8, it's the fourth one. That's if you're still writing Silverlight, but you know. Portable class libraries has been floating around as a CTP for quite a while, and it's now been pulled into the framework as a key part of it. What essentially it does is it provides a facade over the framework, and then when you compile, it can actually determine, pull up the right versions of the classes it needs for the compile, and it also provides you, it will only expose the classes you can actually use, depending on your targets. So I'm going to have a look at a quick demo of this. He's a good man. Okay. So again, all demos are incredibly simplistic. Any Windows 8 applications here are not UI safe. Nor is the code anywhere UI safe. Okay, so basically what I've got here is I've written a API library to call Bing to do web searches and image searches. The key to portable class libraries, if we look at the properties, is... That's the wrong button, everyone. It's this area here, just below. I'm new to Zoomit, I'm working on it. If we open this up here, you can see we get a checkbox and we can select the frameworks we want to target. You can even go down to Xbox 360. It doesn't give you a hell of a lot, but you can do it. If I click on this, it will then ask to install additional frameworks or reduce the the elements I have access to. We'll leave it there. So do that, we would get the same thing. If you play around with this and set one up a reasonably simple restriction and then open up the object browser, you can actually look and see what's been taken out and what's been left in. So at the moment, I don't even want that, so we'll leave that there. I'm not going to really go into the code here. It's a quick look. So it's basically calls Bing, pulls some stuff back. We're all happy. So the key thing with using the portable class library is that it's going to restrict what you have access to. So I've selected Windows 8 as one of my targets, you don't get thread sleep, my favorite method. So you've got to think about those sort of things. But the beauty of this now is that I've actually, once I've compiled it, I can have a reference in a console app. And if we run that, debug start. I think console apps are the future. Don't laugh. Goes off, runs, and I've done a web search and image search there. So it's a class. It's running in a bog simple .NET 4.5 powerful console app. But I can also use it now in a WinApe app, and as you can see here, I've got the reference there. And if I run it, and I do the same search, this one will only look for images. I was going to try and actually write a console app in Windows 8, because they're good. And there, the same thing's working. It's not really doing anything, but the point is that you've got that portability. I'm not having to do any, I'm not going to have to do special compiles, I'm not going to have to create multiple instances of the same class across different projects or anything to accommodate all the different versions, which means I've got a single point for maintaining that thing. There are a couple of gotchas with doing this, though. If you've got any classes you have, so you've got any other custom classes you've written, they also have to be portable class libraries to be used in one. If you go and trying to add a DLL that isn't part of the portable class library, is not recognized by it, it'll just go, nope, you're not a portable class library anymore. That's it. All bets are off. Okay. I keep wanting to press 2. So, those are the sort of three things we wanted to show you about in the framework. But there are probably some other things that I think are worth mentioning. And because I wrote the chapter on the BCL, I have deep, deep love for it. Profile optimization and multi-core JIT sounds great. Can't dance to it. But what it actually does is it allows you to set up a profile, and it will improve the jitting of your application when it starts up. By default, it's switched on in ASP.NET, but it's a configuration to do it on a desktop application. Timeout support for regular expressions, because everyone uses regular expressions. And essentially what that does is that if you've written a regular expression which has gone pear-shaped, it will actually stop at some point rather than just spinning on to infinity. There's a new namespace, system.io.compression, and within that we now have a zip archive class and a zip file class, which actually allows us to create zips. The zip file doesn't work in Windows 8, but zip archive does. Strongly typed weak reference. There's always a bit of a problem with weak references because you're having to cast the object, and there's a possibility it got disposed before you did the cast or after you did the cast. So the strongly typing actually improves that, and they've added some other functionality to kind of minimize the chance of an object disposing before you've actually checked it. And the last one is culture definition for the application domain. We're probably writing more and more applications which are used across national boundaries, and one of the things this does is it allows you to set the culture not only for the current UI thread and the current thread you're running on, but it will actually pass that thread, that culture down through any background threads that you run or any asynchronous operations you run. And that's actually kind of good, because it's otherwise normally what happens is currently if you're using .NET 4 and you set thread, you go into a background thread, you suddenly default to US, which could be embarrassing. Okay, now I'm going to hand it over to Mahesh for All Things Web.
All right, thanks, Will. Okay. How many of your web developers are here? Show of hands, please. Okay, it's probably more than half. Okay, well, there's a lot of new and exciting stuff for you in ASP.NET and, you know, in the framework in general for all the web guys. There are three main things that I'm going to talk about. I'm going to be talking about a new way of writing services using HTTP, using ASP.NET framework. It's called Web API. I'm going to cover that. I'm going to be talking about WebSockets, which is basically a new protocol that you can actually use. And last but not the least, I'm also going to be covering ASP.NET and, you know, basically both web forms and MVC as well. Okay? Now, let's start with Web API. A Web API is basically, well, how many of you have written WCF services or web services in the past? Yeah, pretty much everyone, right? And there's nothing wrong with WCF. I mean, it's got a place in there. It uses all these WSR protocols, and you know, you can hook up to security very easily. You know, you can do complex things, like if you want to hook up to transactions, you know, it's all possible. But a lot of applications that we actually write are a lot simpler. So if you wanted to get a book, for example, one way of doing it is you basically pass a URL, like, you know, server/books, and you pass the ISBN number, and it returns back the book in a very simple format, like XML or JSON, for that matter. If you want a product, you know, same thing. You pass a URL and give the products, and then you get it back. And this is kind of like what the RESTful API is all about. I mean, it's the starting point is, you know, you basically use a common URI in the internet, and it gets back a resource, which is like a book or a product and so on. And if you want to do simple CRUD things, like create, read, update, and delete, you basically use the HTTP actions. So if you wanted to do you know, get a book, you pass the get verb in the, as an action item, as an action verb. If you wanted to do an insert, you do a put. If you wanted to do an update, you do a post. And if you want to delete, you just basically use the delete action. So the HTTP programming model in ASP.NET, it's a new thing that they've actually introduced. Well, it's not really entirely new. It used to be part of WCF. And what they've done is, after several iterations, they've kind of like moved it out of, in fact, it used to be called the WCF Web API to start with, I think. And we've moved it over to Web API itself. It's part of the web ecosystem now. And it supports a whole bunch of things. I mean, if, you know, out of the box, you can do things like content negotiation, which means if you wanted a JSON, you can request for JSON. If you wanted XML, you can request for XML. If you wanted your own type, you can plug in your own type as well in there. It allows things like query composition. So if you wanted to get some data, and then you say, hey, can you just filter on this field, and it'll actually give you back a filtered data set. Or you could actually do things like, I want to do paging, and you can actually do pass that in the query string and things like that. All that is quite, you know, you can easily do all that stuff using Web API. And because you know, a lot of the stuff happens in the URL, in the query string and so on, you know, it's hooked onto the routing that's available in the ASP.NET MVC framework. And although it's all part of the MV, like the web stuff, you can actually self-host it as well. So let's jump in and do a quick demo. So if I want to create it, all I need to do is go pick up an ASP.NET MVC for a web application, say book service. And notice a bunch of templates over here. You pick the Web API template. In the real world, you'd be creating unit tests as well, but let's skip that for now. Now, what this actually does is it goes in and it'll create all the templates for you. And I think my web, okay, it's all good. It's taking a while because it does do a lot of runs NuGet in the background and gets all a whole bunch of stuff. What it does is it goes in and creates all the controllers and things like that. And it's created a controller called Values Controller, which basically extends something known as an API controller. Okay. If I wanted to go and add my own, like say a books controller or something like that, I can go in and say add new controller, add a books controller. Notice that. I've got a bunch of options over here. I can basically go and pick then API controller with empty read-write actions. What that does is it'll write some methods for you that hooks in all the HTTP actions that I was talking about earlier, the HTTP verbs like get and so on, get, put. It wires all that up for me. So if I just do that, it's written in books controller. Now I want to use, rather than pass back strings, which is what the, this is like basically the hello world of it, right? So I want to change it from string to return back a proper object. So let me just do that. I'll change it from string to book. And obviously I need to write a book class. So go over to models and add new class. We'll just call it book. And rather than watch me type all these things, we've got something pre-wired here. I'm not going to go through this class. It's a pretty simple book class. And I'll hook this up with some sample data as well that I've got. Now, along the presentation, if you're not giving any subtle hints of the book that we've written, I mean, like, you know.
What book? Oh, I remember now.
So what I'm doing here is when the HTTP request comes in and says, hey, get me all the books, I'm running all the list of items from the dictionary. And I can also, if they send in an ISBN, I can basically go in and say, hey, send back that right data as well. So I'll, you know, I'll worry about posts and things like that much later on, get rid of that. I'm going to run this app now, and I'm also going to fire up Fiddler. Who uses Fiddler over here? Okay, if you aren't, it's a great tool to have in your kitty. So what I'm going to do, copy that URL into Fiddler. I can basically make requests over here. See that? Put in a request there and type in books and hit enter. Maybe it's book. Okay. So when I did the request, that's the data that actually came back. It's basically written in JSON. And that's the raw data in case you're interested as well. Okay, I can, you know, I was talking about content negotiation earlier, so I can go in over here and say, hey, rather than give me JSON, just can you just get me XML text? And I'll fire this request again. And notice all the data has come back in XML. It's pretty simple to just use out of the box. And I can copy this ISBN in my composer. And that's just basically written back that book alone. So very, very simple to use. Now, I'm not sure whether you were in Andrew Coates' developer keynote yesterday, but he's talking about lazy programmers. Yeah, I happen to be one of them. I still find there's a little bit more work to do. You know, if you're using a database and things like that, you know, this was like a static class and easy to write. You know, how do you hook it up? It turns out there's a pretty easy way of doing that as well. So I'm going to jump into this, I'm going to jump into your machine, actually. So what I've already done is I've used entity frameworks and I've created a bunch of stuff from the database. So you got over there, you see all these employee and company role and all that kind of nice stuff over there, right? If I were to, just if I just wanted to use this from entity frameworks, I can go back to my controllers like I did earlier and say, add controller. And see this option over here that says API controller read write actions using entity framework? I can just hook that up. And once I do that, it ends up creating this class for you. You know, with the Getter employees, it goes up, hooks it up to entry frameworks, gets all the data. And, you know, in my very simple example, I actually didn't do error handling and things like that. But in the real world, you know, if you go look for an ISV or something like that, it, if it's not found, it's got to return back a HTTP status code of 404, which is basically not found. It hooks up all those things for you. So very, very nice to use. So the one other thing that I want to do is, like, you know, with Web API, they've also done some work on the client side. They've introduced something called HTTP client, so which basically allows you to, you know, make calls to REST services or any web page for that matter and get the data back and work with it. So this example over here, so notice that that's the HTTP client that I've initialized. And I can say get async, and you just pass the URL, and it just goes to the address and gets the data back and sends it to you. And I check the response code, see if it's, you know, if it succeeds, and it is basically get the data out of it and then extract it and do it. It's pretty simple and straightforward. So just to see this in action, actually, you don't need to run this. I'll skip over it. So
I did all that work.
Okay. Oh.
Sorry, I was trying to hide my work. I'm not happy about that.
You can run this, okay. The factory, and it's nice pictures of Andy Warhol and everyone else.
I deserve the claps, not him. Thank you.
All right. The next thing I want to talk about is something called WebSockets. Now, yeah, if you've got a site that displays stock ticker information or sports scores and things like that, things that are actually constantly updating on the server, there's no way for the server to actually send you those results every now and then. Say, hey, okay, there you go, you know, the results have changed, here's the result. I mean, there's no way to keep track of all, you know, who's connected and things like that. The way you used to do it is you do polling, which is, you know, you keep hitting the server and say, get me the results, get me the results, get me the results, and so on and so forth, right? Well, a variation of it is something called long polling, which is basically you go and say, get me the results, and you wait until the result actually comes back. And then when the result comes back, you go back and say, get me the result again, and you wait again. So this is not really an efficient way of doing things. So what the web community ended up doing was they ended up creating a new protocol called WebSockets. Now, with WebSockets, what you do is you establish a connection just during a regular HTTP call and establish a sockets after that is done. And so both the server and the client are actually connected. So what you can actually do in the end is, like, it's basically a full duplex bidirectional communication. So the client can send messages to the server, and the server basically send back messages to the client. You know, lots and lots of uses. You know, this is basically built on HTTP. So, you know, you don't have to worry about things like firewalls and proxies. Well, sometimes some proxies you need to worry about it, but yeah, generally it just works quite well. And, you know, it supports things like binary and UTF-8. You know, it's all good. So one caveat, though. If you're using Windows 7, forget XP, right? If you're using Windows 7, it still doesn't work on it. You know, you need IE10 or something like the browser like that to actually work with it. Chrome does work, though. You need IIS8. You know, that list over there, you need that stuff to get it to work. So that's one of the caveats. So I'm going to quickly jump in and do a demo. This is like a simple chat application. Okay, just to explain the application before I actually run it. Or maybe I'll run it first. Okay, it's a simple app. It just says, you know, what's your name? And say Elvis. Let's use another browser. Let's see how I use IE. Yeah, let's say Elvis is talking to Bill.
I see dead people too, just in case anyone wants to know.
Okay, so we've got that nice together. Oh, Bill is connected. So Elvis says, Bill, hey dude. Now what this actually does is, it sends a message to the server, and the server broadcasts it to everyone else, including Bill. So they always said, Bill, hey, dude. Did I say you or dude?
Hey, dude.
Hey, dude.
So I'm a library book as well.
Nobody calls me dude. Have you seen my tattoos? I think El was intimidated. I can't even type now. And I am leaving. And El has left the building. Anyway, the way to implement this is, you know, it seems like a simple, you know, it's a chat application, right? But it's very, very simple to implement. So what's been done over here is, we've got a simple HTTP handler. And the HTTP handler basically looks at the request that actually comes in and says, hey, is it a WebSocket request? If it is, accept the WebSocket request and pass it over to this handler over here. And the WebSocket handler implements a web, the class actually implements a WebSocket handler. It's got an on open, it looks at the message and reads the message and basically broadcasts it. You can actually see it's a pretty simple application. That's because ASP.NET does all the heavy lifting for you. Okay. Last but not the least, I want to talk about ASP.NET. The number of changes that have actually come into ASP.NET, both web forms and MVC. By the way, how many of you use web forms over here? Just show of hands still. And how many have switched over to MVC? Okay, it's half and half. It's pretty interesting. Okay. Well, statistically, you know, Microsoft basically said, oh, I think about 80% of people are still using web forms at the moment. So just thought I'll ask. One of the things that they've actually introduced in MVC, in ASP.NET web forms, is strongly typed data controls. So in the past, you used things like eval, and you'd pass in a string to it, like last name, and used for data binding. And I mean, it's okay, but the thing though is if you decide to change last name to something like surname, you wouldn't know until you run the application, because that is actually done at runtime. With the new changes, you can actually pass in the type of object that you want to bind it to the control, and then basically pass that you can say data item dot actual type of the property itself. I'll show that in a demo. And you have heaps of other things that have been added. I mean, async await, kind of permeated across the whole framework. This is no exception. So there's some improved async support over here. Minification of JavaScript and CSS. You can bundle together all these files. And minification is basically the process of, if you've got like JavaScript and CSS, it strips out all the white spaces, and you've got names like variable names and things like that. It shortens them as well. It just makes the payload really small. Plus, because it bundles all of them together, you basically just make one request to the server to get all the JavaScript or just get all the CSS. So all that is there. And of course, there's HTML5 is coming, and the server controls are all updated to support HTML5. So if you wanted like an email type or something like that, or all that is included in, like, say, a text box. So all that is there. ASP.NET, MVC, the templates that have all been refreshed. So I'm not sure if you've been to any of the web, if you've seen any demos, but if you go in and create a simple MVC app, the template is pretty slick. It looks very nice. It works really well with mobile devices and things like that. And they have improved a whole bunch of other things for mobile devices as well. And of course, again, async. In the past, you'd have to, if you wanted to create an async controller, you've got to derive out of a class called async controller, and you used to have callbacks and things like that. All that is gone now. So you basically just use async, and it just works quite well. So I want to quickly show you a demo. On ASP.NET, And there are three things that I wanted to target. So let me just run this real quick. So the first thing I want to show is how data mining actually works. I want to show you the strongly typed data controls. I want to show you model binding, and finally some of the other things like we'll touch along the way, things like you know, how routing, which you've used in MVC, is now, you know, you can use that for web forms as well. So let me jump into web forms. If you look at the code over here, in the past, you do binding like that. So you basically say data bind, you know, eval, and then you pass in an actual string. You don't have to do that anymore. So what you do is, if you look at the code over there at the top, you've got an item type over here, and you pass in the type of object that you're binding it to. And here, you basically say bind item.firstname or bind item.lastname. Now, one of the other things is that you can basically go ahead and say, hey, this is the select method that you use to get a bunch of data back. And you can also specify things like what is the method that you use for updating, and you know, and so on. If you go over to the person application, person class, let me do that now. Notice that it's got some validation over here, required, first name is required. So if I go in to my application and do, take that out and hit update, it comes back to this method over here, the update method, update people method, and it validates this. So let's just run through this. Notice it actually says first name is required. It does the validation and things like that. All that is kind of like baked into the framework, so it just makes it easy for you. As Koti said, you know, just the lazy programmer paradigm, right? So just do what you really need to do. All this just works out of the box for you. Now I can go into this other screen over here and then type in last name equals Krishnan. Not sure whether you actually notice that. Two things that you'll notice. One is I actually given a query parameter, a query string over there with last name equals Krishnan, and it did the filtering for me, right, number one. Number two is, notice that there's no .aspx over there at the top, okay? And that's because of routing. So the first thing is, in my binding demo, 2.aspx.cs, notice this over here that I've added, last name, and I've actually said it's from the query string. In the past, you would have to do something like this. You don't need to bother. That's done automatically by the framework. It just puts that in, passes the value, and then gives it to you. And then you can just go ahead and then, you know, just do your link statement or whatever it is that you want to do. And let's look at the routing as well. So I've gone ahead and added a bunch of routing. So I've said, hey, for demo, if I say demo one, it really points to bindingdemo.aspx file. So it's a nice and friendly URL at the top that you can actually use. Okay, that's it from me for now on the web. There's lots of stuff. You know, that they've not lots of exciting stuff that they added to web related stuff. But, you know, we've got only a short time to show it. So, you know, just Bill will be there over there in tomorrow or in afternoon, I think. And I'll be there as well. Yeah. In the speaker lounge. So come over and have a chat with us.
Okay. So the pillars of .NET 3.0. There used to be four pillars and one disappeared and there's three and I still don't want to think about it, there's going to be any more going. So how many people write WPF apps? Yeah, there's some of you here. Use WCF. See, there's a lot of you. Workflow Foundation? Oh, I've got one. So you're going to get all my attention shortly, okay? You're mine. Okay. So we're going to look at these three areas. Again, you know, there are changes being made to these areas. You know, they are being proven. Everyone's talking Windows 8. Everyone's talking REST services. But, you know, this is bread and butter stuff. This is what businesses build their applications on. You know, it's not going away anytime soon unless we start using console apps. Okay, so WCF, personal favorite of mine. I haven't quite gone REST yet. I'm working up to it. I'm still on training wheels. So they've made some changes with WCF in this release and some things. One of the key things they've set out to do is to make it easier to configure. Anyone who's used WCF in anger knows that trying to edit that config file is a recipe for disaster. One wrong attribute and the whole thing takes a walk. What they've done is they've simplified that configuration, but what they've made really useful is that if you're editing it, you've got IntelliSense, you get tooltips that actually does some validation to ensure you're actually pointing to the right endpoint, you're actually using the right service name. And this makes a big difference. The other thing they've done is that the default settings that you normally use, you get with WCF, all the way up to 4.0, weren't sensible. Podcast, I think I was listening to, the guy who worked on the team found out that their testers were actually changing those settings to make the thing run well. So they think, we should use those settings. So with this release they have. They've actually implemented production-ready default values for running WCF, which I think is going to make a big difference. The other thing they've done is also made it very easy to configure by code now. So they've actually exposed, by convention, there's a static method you can add to your service, and it will take a service configuration, and you can actually do all your configuration in code. Proxies now, as we mentioned before, define async methods by default. So if I go and create a proxy, whether it's a Windows 8 app, or just a standard desktop app, or a console app, you'll get both. You'll get asynchronous methods out of the box there. You can also, if you're so inclined, you can create an operation that is that has a value or parameter, a value of task. So I can actually go public task string operation. It doesn't return a task, it still returns that value underneath, but it will behave exactly like an async method. WebSockets, which we were talking about before, has also been implemented with WCF. It is a NuGet package, so it's not out of the box. You've actually got to pull down a package to do it. But it does answer that problem of actually trying to get two-way communication and stops us from having to do little ping methods. And it's also implemented UDP protocol. Finally, WCF support does have support for Windows 8 apps. So just because, you know, it's the new shiny thing, it will still work with WCF. To that end, I will actually show a demonstration of using WCF with Windows 8 because you're not going to believe me otherwise. You'll think it's just a story I've been telling you. Okay, so I can see code, you can't. Okay, I think that always makes for a good demonstration. Okay, so I've got a really simple method here. I've actually got at the back of this, I've got a database that contains airport data. Airport name, city name, country, latitude and longitude, airport code. And all we're going to do with this, I expose to get all international airports, because that only returns 511 airports as opposed to the ludicrous number I've got in there. Amazingly, Antarctica is in there, but it doesn't have an airport code, so I'm not sure how you book flights there yet. Get nearest airport, which we pass in a location and a distance, and it will find the nearest airports to that location. And I can also get distance between airports, so it takes two airport IDs. The actual implementation of that is over here, and it's really simple. Something that I'm using here is I'm actually using Entity Framework, and though we're not talking about it today, it didn't pass the audition, is that I'm actually using Entity Framework in this, and it can actually now, you should be noted, it can use data types in Entity Framework. So geography and geometry work with an Entity Framework talking to SQL Server. And so you can do link statements against those classes, which makes writing the stuff a little bit easier. As I report, the one thing I do want to point out to you here is I've actually put in that configure method, which is what I mentioned before, the convention. And at this point, I can actually set up my behaviors, set up my endpoints, and configure them. I can even pull in other configuration files into that and use them. So I could actually set up external configuration files and then reference them and pull them in and set up my configuration. Just as a quick detour, this application doesn't do anything. But what I did want to show you here is that I did create a proxy. And as you can see, by default, I've got a synchronous version, synchronous version of Get All International Airports, and I've got an async version as well. So that's what happens now when you pull the proxies out, which I think makes things a little easier than it used to. Okay, so because Windows 8 is everything, we've got a Windows 8 app here. And who cares? I do. And this is my client. So I create airport client. If we go and look at this just for reference, you'll see that I only actually get async methods here. So you can't do synchronous at all. It actually knows that it's in Windows 8. The other interesting thing, Windows 8 doesn't use config files. So if you drilled into, I'm not going to do this because it's scary, but if I went and dived in here and looked into the reference CS file, you'll actually see that the configuration is done in code to manage setting up endpoints and the like. And in theory, you could go in there, because it's a partial class, you could actually add on to that as well. So that's kind of cool. And you don't have to worry about your end users playing with the config file. I can fix that. Okay. And then we just run it. I was definitely in the wrong place then. Did I do something? Which page? Quickly. Okay, thank you.
Just go ahead.
Sweet. You shouldn't let me near a keyboard. It's just like bad.
Talk of pair programming, room full of people.
Yeah. Actually, it's really hard pair programming with, you know, what, 200 people? Because everyone has a different opinion. I'm thinking of setting up a numbering system for it. Okay, so this incredibly beautiful looking application. What I've done is I've gone out, I've got it using locations, so it found my current location, and I set a distance of 2,000 kilometers to find me the nearest international airport, and it's brought me back to. And if I click on that, it's gone off and done it. And it's very effective and very efficient. So it all works, and that's the point I'm trying to make here, is that, what's that? Were you being cynical?
No, never.
The key thing was to show is that it works really simply, you know.
I'm trying to hurry you up, sorry.
He's trying to hurry me up. Over to you.
I want to quickly touch upon all the things in WPF, the new things in WPF. You know, WPF4, there are a whole bunch of new controls that came through from Cellulite. I think we had the data grid, date control, calendar control, and things like that. With WPF 4.5, you just get one new control, but it's actually a significant one. The ribbon control is now out of the box. You still need to use windows.controls.ribbon or something of that sort. And once you import the library, you know, you can basically use the ribbon. It's basically a bunch of controls that you can plug in and start using them. In addition, there are other things that we've actually borrowed from Cellulite. One of that is basically validating asynchronously. In the past, you basically use iData error info, and you implement that, and you have your error handling in there. But if your error handling routine or your validation took an awful lot of time, it just doesn't work well. So going with this asynchronous theme, we kind of like use the iNotify data error info. We brought it from Cellulite and put it into WPF, and you can use that now. There are also a bunch of data binding changes. The most important ones are probably the ones, there's something known as a delay property binding. So
you know, when you actually make a change to the data and you data bound it to something else, or even the data or another control, you can basically say, hey, don't set the value for another 100 milliseconds or something like that. And it's got its uses. In fact, you know, I found a use for it the other day because I didn't want the messages going back very, very quickly to another control to update it. You also have binding to static properties, which, you know, kind of like, I'm not sure whether how many of you have actually bound to static property, but if you're using static properties, then there are some, they've introduced a whole bunch of events and things like that to actually trigger IE notify, you know, to notify the UI that our data has basically changed, and so it can actually reflect that. Markup extension for events. Previously, you couldn't actually write markup events. Now you can, and it's really good because it kind of like fits in with MVVM pattern and things like that. You know, write your own events and bind it. It just works pretty well. Now I'm kind of like hurrying up because we're running out of time, and want to talk about workflow foundation, Bill?
Okay. I suddenly have no, there we go. Okay, so where's my workflow guy? Oh, there he is. I'm only talking to him, so you guys just, you know, chat among yourselves. Okay, workflows had a rocky ride. It's got traction in various areas. You'll find TFS now uses workflow to manage builds and stuff. But, you know, it's up and down. But 4.0, they basically did the whole thing from the ground up. And they're really making an effort. In this version of workflow, you can now use C# expressions. Interestingly enough, up until 4.5, even if you create a C# project, the expressions you used in activities had to be written in VB, which seemed to do, you know, offend C# programmers for some reason. I haven't worked out yet. You can now do contact first workflow services. If you create a workflow service, you can define that contract, and then it will actually generate all the activities you need to manage it. Workflow versioning, using the new workflow identity class. This is particularly important when you're persisting workflows over a long period of time. If a workflow gets updated and then you rehydrate a previously existed workflow, it can actually crash. People have had to hand roll their own versioning. With this one, you can actually now version that and then make sure you load the correct version of the workflow against the correct activity workflow you're actually hydrating. You can also dynamically update workflows using versioning. And there was one other thing, but I forgot it, so I'm just going to step over it. The other thing they've done, they've made a lot of improvements to the authoring and designer tools. So you can add comments now to all your activities. There's better browsing of the especially complex workflows. You can get document outlines, stuff like that. I have to say, I wrote the chapter on this, and I haven't looked at workflow since it first came out, and I even started to like it. So I think the changes they made are good, and they're aware that developers don't necessarily think visually, but they're trying to work towards that. Okay, other cool stuff. This is stuff we had to just drop here because we really didn't know where else to put it. So first cab out of the rank, MEF 2.0. Who's used MEF? Yeah. Okay, so, you know, extensibility framework, it was, you know, initially designed to allow you to allow your application to load third-party DLLs into your system so you could use them. It was based on using attributes for import and export. That's kind of cool. So, but with the 2.0 version, they've actually tried to move it closer to an IOC. Previously, people say MEF is not IOC. IOC is IOC. But the team who've worked on it have tried to pull it closer together. Some of the key things they've implemented with this and with this version, support for open generics. So if I define a property or that I have an import, I only have to define the broad type. I don't have to define the concrete implementation. MEF will work that out for me and hydrate the correct thing in. Convention-based registration. People are divided on using attributes. Some people don't mind them. Other people think they're pure evil. I think to address that, they've introduced convention-based registration. Primarily what it allows you to do is using the new registration builder, build rules to determine which parts get imported and exported without having to use attributes. That becomes particularly useful, say, on internal projects where you don't want your developers having to remember to add attributes. But if you have a convention where all the view models end in view model, I can set up a rule that will load all those classes as long as they end with that term. Composition scoping enhancements. This allows you to get more atomic management of the lifetime of child objects and ensure that you're not sharing across object boundaries, and that's kind of cool. Diagnostic improvements. One of the biggest complaints about meth, it has the most opaque diagnostic messages you've ever come across. They've attempted to improve that. They've actually put the important stuff at the top rather than at the bottom. So it now makes it a bit easier to understand what's going on, especially when it blows up on you. And lastly, meth for Metro and web apps. So what they've actually done is this has been spun off as a NuGet package, and they've actually introduced a new composition engine, a lightweight one, to particularly targets the requirements of web and Metro. It also allows for convention-based registration, but it uses a different class. So that's kind of cool. I did have a demo, but I'm going to fly right past that one. If you're interested in it, you can come and see me. I'm demoing somewhere, some point. It's up on the screen later. Okay, the TPL, the Task Parallel Library. This is not new. I think we had it last year, the year before. It's been around for a while, 4.0. But they've added some new features in it. So one of the key things they worked on was performance. So performance has been one of those stories that's been running all the way through the framework. And that's one of their key focuses. It's claimed that if you just upgrade to 4.5, you get an immediate performance improvement on anything that's using the Task Parallel Library. They've added a bunch of new methods to Task. Most of them are statics. Run, which is ostensibly a shortcut to going task.factory.start. I think that's the correct syntax. Yes, I got the nod on that one. I'm correct. Delay, which is kind of like asynchronous sleep. And though I thought it was there for demo, someone did say they used it in a production application, so it must be useful. When any, it allows you to run a collection of tasks, and then it will actually respond when the first one comes back. You can also set it up to loop through them and remove them off a queue. When all, similar, takes a set of tasks and doesn't do anything until they've all returned. And from result, which is a kind of a cute one, if you've got a method that calls out to a web service to return some values, you can, in principle, you can cache that value. So the next time when it calls, you can actually check to see if you've already got that value. You can then call task from result, and it'll just push that value back rather than you making that call again. So again, that's a performance enhancement, and it's kind of cool. And the progress class. So they've introduced interface iProgress and a base class progress of t. This allows you to pass this into a method, and it actually allows you to report back up to the calling code to actually report on the progress of something. And that's very nice. Okay, finally, does a time check. Good. Okay, TPL data flow. This is new. So what is TPL data flow? I decided to just put a really big piece of text up here because everyone needs to read occasionally. But basically what this is moving on to the next level from Task Parallel Library. This is starting looking at reactive systems. We're looking at setting up in-memory data flows, processing pipelines, agent-based controls. It essentially, did anyone read that? Everyone still reading? Hands up. Good. Yeah, speed reading is good. I learned to do it in primary school. Okay, so ostensibly, it's a set of primitives referred to as blocks. And each block is essentially consists of a queue and a task. And so I spin up my block, and it sits there, and it waits for someone to send a message to it. Message goes into the buffer, and then the task will spin up when it's got a message in the buffer. I can put 10 messages in that. That task will just keep spinning up, processing each message sequentially. And depending on the type of block, we'll either do something with that message, or we'll then pass it on down the pipe. They only ever runs by default a single task, but you can set it up for parallel tasks, so you can get it to spin up 4 tasks at once, or whatever you want to do. And some key examples of blocks are the action block, which can just take information, a transform block, which will take a post, do something to it, and then send it on. And something like the buffer block, which actually allows, just a queue, just allows you to queue things up. Do we want to see a demo of that?
Yeah,
okay. I'm not going to show you the console app application demo, which I thought would be really nice. But I've written a WF application.
I've got 2 minutes to wrap up.
Who wants to see the demo? Anybody? It's not going to make any sense because, but I thought I might show it anyway. I've basically got a set of blocks here, let me just show you something very quickly. So this is a transform block. When I create a transform block, I define the input and the output. I then define the lambda expression where I do my work. In this case, I've got yet another Bing search because I can't get enough, which will return a message. And this transform block many will actually take that collection that's returned and break them up into separate messages. If we look at a normal transfer block, similar kind of thing, input, output, and then within the lambda expression, we do whatever we want to do with it. I'm going to quickly run this, and I think we can start summing up. I'm going to ad-lib at this point. So what I've actually got here is a series of message processing stuff. We're good. We've got 5 minutes. Hey, stage whispering doesn't work when you're wearing a mic. Just going to point that out to you if you get stuck up here. And what you can see now is that that's just running processes. I can actually go into here, and I can type in a new search, and that will start. That will just kick off and keep running. If there's nothing happening, the stuff just sits there and waits. Okay, so it's very much like the reactive framework. I think it's very powerful. It still confuses me a little. But that's how it is. If you want to know more about it, I'm happy to talk and show you more closely if you're interested. One.
Okay, there you go. You've already done the demo. And just wrapping up, I've got some T-shirts to give away, by the way. So before any questions, the first person who doesn't ask a question gets a T-shirt. All right, you didn't get the joke anyway.
No, I think they got the joke. That was what worries me.
So just to wrap things up, so Bill, what do you think are the main takeaways from this presentation? What do you think are the coolest features? And
oh, okay, so I'm biased. Anything I wrote about, I think is good. Okay, so I was really lucky. I did BCL and CLR. I did MEF. I did workflow, and I have learnt some love for it. So I think they're the good stuff. There's some great stuff in the BCL, and it's worth digging into. You can't get away from async await. I mean, it is probably... it just simplifies the whole process. But again, it's a bit like, I think you've got to be careful with it. That's my only thing. I think MEF 2 is really interesting as well.
Okay. Well, I think, if I were to pick one feature, it would probably be the async await. It's probably, the number one feature that's kind of like permeates across the whole framework. And it's, it's so easy to use and, it's everywhere. It's pretty good. I think some of the web features, web stuff, like the web API and, web sockets and all that has got a pretty good future as well. There's lots of stuff in .NET 4.5 that it's worth taking a look at. I think the stuff that Bill was showing, the last demo and all that is pretty cool. So I think there's a lot of place for that. And with that, we want to wrap up. We'll be around. I'll be around in the speaker lounge. I think Bill, there's some time zone here, isn't there?
Yeah, go back. So I'm in the speaker lounge tomorrow between 11 and 11:30. I'm also on the demo pods both tomorrow and Friday. It'd probably be a great time to talk. Yeah. So I'm happy to dive into things at that point.
Yeah.
Keep going. There's more slides.
Yeah, and of course, if you want to learn more, just go and buy our book from Amazon.
Okay, finally.
Okay, no one's got any questions?
Complete your session evaluation.
Whoa, I didn't go very far, did it? Yeah.
Okay, send him a large. We've got a large.
All right, I'm going to go back.
Okay, thank you very much.